call the case of Hudson and Wright versus Marion and Jean Wakefield. Counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. John Burgle will argue for petitioner.
May it please the court. I represent Robert Hudson and Andy Wright, purchasers under a contract for sale of real estate. Back in March of 1981, Robert Hudson and Andy Wright and Marion and Jean Wakefield voluntarily entered into a contract for sale of 186 acres, more or less, of land owned by Marion and Jean Wakefield and situated in Freestone County, Texas. This land and this contract was evidenced by a written instrument, which is in the record, which provided that Marion and Jean Wakefield agreed to sell and Robert Hudson and Andy Wright agreed to buy this land for a purchase price and consideration more specifically described in the contract, the total value of which was in excess of $200,000. This contract also had many different provisions which related to earnest money, which related to the performance of the contract, and which related to the types and similar matters that govern such contracts in the law and in the state of Texas. Robert Hudson and Andy Wright signed this contract, and along with a check in the amount of $5,000, in the amount called for in the contract, delivered that contract to Marion and Jean Wakefield. Marion and Jean Wakefield signed that contract, and in the presence of the broker, Marion Wakefield took that contract and the check to the title company named in the contract, tendered the check to the title company, tendered the check, or rather the earnest money contract, to the title company, and demanded that the title company proceed to open title and that the contract close. Shortly thereafter, it became known to my client, Robert Hudson and Andy Wright, that Marion and Jean Wakefield, apparently on the same day or the day after, signed another contract to sell the very same piece of property to a man by the name of J.W. Robinson, who I believe the record reflects is the same J.W. Robinson here today and representing Marion and Jean Wakefield as co-counsel in the court below. Immediately upon learning that, Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright, through me, instituted specific performance suit in Freestone County, Texas, demanding a conveyance of that property and demanded a release of the contract that had been signed apparently between the Wakefields and Mr. Robinson. That release was provided. That release was filed of record, and a copy was sent to Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright. However, at the very same time that this was going on, Mr. Hudson, who had made arrangements with First International Bank in Houston, Texas, that a check and had advised First International Bank in Houston, Texas, which was the bank upon which that $5,000 check was drawn, had advised First International Bank that that check was coming, had made arrangements with First International Bank that money was available for the complete and full funding of that check, and then had tendered that check to the title company. The title company, without any advice whatsoever or communication with Mr. Hudson or Mr. Wright or First International Bank in Houston, did not send that check through the ordinary commercial channel, but rather sent the check for collection. And when the check received, or when the check was received by First International Bank, due to an error on the part of the bank, which is more fully explained by the affidavits of the bank officers, which are on file with this court, and a letter from the bank officer, which is one of the exhibits attached to the deposition of the officer of the title company on file with this court, First International Bank returned the check unpaid. This was due, and admittedly due, on the part of the bank, to error on the part of the bank. For the bank affirms that at all times, Robert Hudson had funds well sufficient to pay that check. When the check came back to the title company looked at the check and realized that it had been returned. And, as the title company officer testified on the deposition, on file with this court, chose at that point in time to close the file and to take no further actions on the basis of two reasons. Number one, it was their corporate policy that they didn't run checks through a second time. And secondly, she didn't have enough time and she didn't want to fool with it. Immediately upon learning of this situation, and I might add that Mr. Hudson, and this is reflected in the record, did not learn of this situation until over a month after the check had been given to the title company. Immediately upon learning of this situation, Mr. Hudson called the title company and said, it's been an error on the part of the bank, run the check through again. And that was confirmed by a letter from the bank, which stated that at all times, and indeed if the check was run through again, the full and complete and entire $5,000 would be paid. The title company refused to do so for the same reasons. Now, at that point in time, the lawsuit had been filed because of this second contract that had been signed. And approximately that time, a release was provided. But at that point in time, the title company in the Wakefield then said, we're not going to perform the contract. Mr. Robert Hudson, in an effort to perform and to deliver the funds, wired $5,000 in cash money from Houston, Harris County, Texas, to Fairfield, Texas in Freestone, a distance of well in excess of 150 miles. The Freestone, or the Fairfield State Bank in Fairfield, Texas, had the money available, which was the same bank as the title company, and Mr. Hudson advised the title company, the money is across the street, it is available to you. The title company refused to get it. The title company refused to go take it. The Wakefields refused it. Finally, in an effort to comply and to perform the contract through agent, which agent's affidavit is on file with this court, Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright obtained a cashier's check from those funds, took the cashier's check to the title company, and tendered the $5,000 check to the title company in the form of a cashier's check, which was, has been, is now, and is always available to the purchasers, or rather to the sellers, under this contract for full and complete performance, as well as Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright being ready, willing, and able at all times to perform all obligations under this contract and to consummate the sale of the 186 acres. The title company officer arranged not to be there that day, and the title company refused to accept the money. At which point in time, the Wakefields, and through and by and through their attorney, moved for summary judgment in the case. After discovery, both parties moved for summary judgment, and a hearing was had in the district court in Freestone County, Texas. At that hearing, the motion for summary judgment of the then defendants, now respondents, Marion and Jean Wakefield, was granted. The motion for summary judgment at that hearing of now petitioners, then plaintiffs, Robert Hudson and Andy Wright, was denied. That motion for summary judgment was appealed by Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright through me to the 10th Court of Civil Appeals in Waco, Texas. And the 10th Court of Civil Appeals, in an opinion, handed down a decision on the sole and single point, which is the same point that this court has granted the writ of error on, that the deposit of the $5,000 money with the title company was a condition precedent to the validity of the contract, which I might add Mr. Hudson and myself and Mr. Wright vehemently deny and disagree with. That opinion and that decision was thereafter appealed by writ of error to this court, whereupon this court granted the writ of error. And the decision today and the question before the court is whether, in fact, under this contract, the deposit or delivery of money to the title company was in fact a condition to the validity of the contract. We submit to the court, and our position most earnestly and most vehemently is that it was not. That contract was in full force and effect at the time that it was signed, that Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright did everything humanly possible to perform the contract, that they were at all times ready, willing, and able to perform that contract, that they did to the best of their ability perform the contract, that they are now ready to perform the contract to pay the purchase price and to purchase the acreage that Marion and Jean Wakefield freely and voluntarily contracted and agreed to sell them when the contract was signed. We submit to the court, not only are those the facts in the case, but the law also supports the position of Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright. Why is this the case? I submit to the court that the law up until now has been, and I submit to this court that it should be, that the deposit of earnest money with the title company or with any third-party stakeholder is not a condition to the formation of a contract for sale of real estate, and certainly not in this case. Now, that is not to say that two parties freely contracting and agreeing could not agree among themselves and between themselves that such a deposit of an earnest money or deposit of money could be a condition. Indeed, a contract so stated and signed between the parties that said the deposit of certain amounts of earnest money in a certain place by a certain time shall be a condition preceding to the validity of this contract is not something that is an anomaly in the law, and it is not something that should necessarily not be enforced. But conditions, which if not met, result in a forfeiture of rights, conditions are not favored in the law. If there is any reasonable construction of a contract that will cause a condition or to cause a set of circumstances not to be a condition, but rather to be a covenant, it will be so construed. Additionally, conditions are created and interpreted by the use of not any specific form of language, but of certain types of language, that is conditional language, words such as if, and unless, and on condition that, none of which appear in the contract. Considering those principles, which have been decided by this court on numerous occasions, most recently by Justice Pope in the case of Schwartz Jordan Inc. versus Delisle Construction Company, which was decided on July 19, 1978, and it is 569 Southwest 2nd, 868, and cited in my brief. It is a rule of construction that a forfeiture by finding a condition precedent is to be avoided when possible under another reasonable reading of the contract. And another Supreme Court case, the case of Hohenberg Brothers Company versus George E. Gibbonson Company, decided by this court on May 12, 1976, specifically provides, where the intent of the parties is doubtful or where a condition would impose an absurd or impossible result, then the agreement will be interpreted as creating a covenant rather than a condition. Since forfeitures are not favored, courts are inclined to construe them otherwise. While no particular words are necessary for the existence of a condition, such terms as if, provided that, on condition that, or some other phrase that conditions performance usually connote an intent for a condition rather than a promise. In the absence of such a limiting clause, whether a certain contractual provision is a condition rather than a promise must be gathered from the contract as a whole and the intent of the parties. And that brings us to the contract in question, because this contract in question, I submit to the court, is of necessity, in fact and law, the best evidence of the intention of the parties. What does the contract say? Section 1 of this contract, which of course is a matter of record and is in the record, Section 1 of this contract, I submit, is one of the best provisions and some of the best evidence in that regard. Seller hereby agrees to convey and purchaser hereby purchases and agrees to pay for the tract of land containing 186.69 acres more or less, being more particularly described as follows, and thereafter by exhibit follows a legal description. There is no conditional language. I submit to the court that is absolute language of agreement to purchase and sell. And I might add that in the case of Cowman versus Allen Monuments, a case cited in my brief, decided by, I believe, the Court of Appeals in Eastland, it was specifically, excuse me, Your Honor, you're absolutely right, it is Texarkana, decided by the Court of Civil Appeals in Texarkana, and the Court of Civil Appeals in Texarkana specifically stated that the mutual promises in a contract for sale of real estate is sufficient consideration to make those mutual promises binding between the parties. That creates a contract. And in the absence of a specific agreed to condition, the deposit of earnest money or other acts, not necessarily including or not necessarily limited to the deposit of earnest money, are not conditions to the validity of the contract. Secondly, Article 2 of the contract specifically states that the $5,000, which was to be deposited with the earnest money, or rather to be deposited with the title company, what was the purpose of that? It was to be paid at closing. There was a certain amount of cash to be paid at closing, and the $5,000 was to be deducted from the amount due at closing from the purchasers, for the $5,000 was already there, and the purchasers would make up the difference.
All right, Mr. Burkle, Slam Properties was a case that held a condition preceding, was it not?
Yes, sir.
All right. Let me read to you the language in Slam Properties and ask you to distinguish it from the language in this contract. Purchase price is $65,000, payable as follows: $6,000 cash, of which the purchaser is deposited with commercial title, the sum of $6,000 is earnest money and part payment, receipt of which is hereby acknowledged by said deposit holder. That was held to be a condition preceding. Distinguish that from the language in the contract in this case for the purpose of securing the performance of purchaser under the terms and provisions of this agreement. Purchaser has delivered to Freestone County Title Company the sum of $5,000, the escrow deposit, which shall be paid to seller in the event of breach. At closing, the escrow deposit shall be paid over to seller and applied to the cash portion of the purchase price.
Yes, Your Honor, and much of the distinguishing features comes directly from that language, because the language of that contract right there specifically states the purpose of that, not the purpose of performing or holding or making or creating a condition to the validity of the contract, but for the purpose of securing performance. Now, when is a contract for sale of real estate to be performed? It is ultimately to be performed at closing. The agreement arises in law and becomes binding when it is signed, but it is performed at closing, when the money is paid, when the deed is delivered, and when the other things incident and necessary to a conveyance of title in the state are performed. And that particular provision in this particular contract specifically states that it is not the purpose of the deposit of earnest money to create a condition, but rather it is to secure performance. Additionally, in Slam Properties, a reading of the case, I believe Your Honor will indicate that in Slam Properties there was not a deposit of money, and there was no intent to deposit the money. And another case, cited by the Court of Appeals in this particular instance, Bowles versus Ficus, is distinguishable on the same ground. In those particular cases, there was no attempt whatsoever, I believe, to deposit the money with the appropriate stakeholder until such time as after the contract had been withdrawn and after the sellers of the land said, we do not want to perform. In this particular case, a check, which was absolutely good, it was returned only for the reason that the bank made an error. A check which was absolutely good was delivered to the sellers, Marion and Gene Wakefield. Did they object to the check? No. They appeared at the title company at that day, check in one hand, contract in the other, in the company of the broker, and in the presence of the officer of the title company, all of which is established by the deposition of the officer of the title company in this cause, handed the check to the title company, handed the contract to the title company, and said, we want to sell our land. Let's proceed. In law, tender by check is good under the following circumstances, and the cases are cited in my brief. Number one, that good funds were available to pay the check. That's established in the record as a matter of fact and a matter of law. Number two, that the check would be paid if presented in the ordinary course of business, but for the error it would have been, which error is as much, if not more, the fault of the title company in failing to advise the parties of the unusual way the title company was going to send that check, as much as it is the bank.
Yeah, but you're not suggesting to this court that it's unusual to send an out-of-town check for collection, is it?
It is less usual than simply sending it in the normal way, but it is not something that it is not done. However, if the title company was going to do it in other than the normal way, all the title company had to do is advise Mr. Hudson, or advise Mr. Wright, or advise the bank, and that would have been done. And then the check itself would have been paid, because at all times the funds were available and the funds were ready. And unfortunately, the check didn't get to the right desk at the right place in the right large area, First International Bank in Houston.
I'm missing something here. Why was it not honored when sent through by collection and would have been had it just been sent through the regular channel?
That's established in the record, Your Honor. There is a letter identified by the officer of the title company from the bank, and then there's the two affidavits from the officer of the bank. And that when the check came to First International Bank for collection, it was not presented to this officer as another check sent in the ordinary course would have been. Had this officer been presented the check, which I must earnestly stress to the court is not at all an unusual set of circumstances, when this officer would see the check, he would determine whether the appropriate arrangements had been made to honor the check. And in this particular case, the officer swore twice into affidavits and wrote once in a letter that he was prepared to do so, that Mr. Hudson had made all of the arrangements, and that if it had been presented to him as it should have been, he would have authorized the advance of the funds. Mr. Hudson had funds with the bank in interest-bearing accounts, and all that needed to be done is to advance them. Unfortunately, the check didn't get to where it needed to go.
The check was returned because of insufficient funds in the account when presented, was it not?
No, Your Honor, we have to dispute that. In this particular case, the check was returned unpaid. All evidence of insufficient funds is absolute hearsay.
Well, was there money in the account?
In the specific numbered account on which the check was drawn, no. That is a true statement. But insufficient funds, Your Honor, I submit to the court, connotes far more than simply that particular account, especially in a case like this, which is a not unusual commercial situation, where non-interest-bearing accounts are generally kept low, and interest-bearing accounts are kept high, and as soon as a check is presented on the non-interest-bearing accounts, funds are advanced. Indeed, I submit to the court, that is wise cash management. And that's the kind of thing that will and should be encouraged as far as commercial transactions are concerned in this state. To do otherwise is to cause oneself to lose the advantages that are available in normal and standard transactions in the banking and the lending industry throughout this state. And therein lies the problem. Because,
well, getting back to this ordinary course of business, why is it not ordinary course of business for a bank halfway across the state to say, we're going to send it down for collection instead of us bearing the float time?
That is not something that is illegal, but that is not the usual way that it is done, simply, Your Honor, because the usual way as far as the number
of things...
Are you testifying now, or do you want me to testify?
I believe that's in the affidavit of the various affidavits of the officers, that this is not the usual way. Not that it is illegal, But it's not the usual way.
Well, does that exclude it being not in the ordinary course of business just because they don't usually get the major part of their checks that way?
I think that an argument could be made, Your Honor, that it is. Not that, again, not that it is illegal, but that it is not the usual and ordinary course of business.
Does it say that it's not the usual and ordinary course of business for an abstract company that's a stakeholder in a contract to send its checks through for collection?
It's not illegal.
Does your affidavit say that? That it's not in the ordinary course of business for a title company?
I do not know that the affidavit says that it is not in the ordinary course of business of a title company. But of course, the check that was presented is a check that must be presented to a lending institution or a depository of funds, which is the banks and the savings and loans. And if you're talking about the ordinary course of business, I submit to the court, you look at the course of business out of which the instrument arises, it is not really in the usual course of business.
Right. Did the abstract company know about these special arrangements that had been made?
There is no evidence that the abstract company knew about the special arrangements.
They just had a check that they wanted to get their money on, and they sent it to the bank, and the bank said there was no money.
Well, the bank returned the check unpaid. There is, I believe the check just came back in the ordinary course of business. I think that...
You would charge them, the abstract company, with knowing that any special arrangements that one of its customers may have made in connection with the check.
Your Honor, but I would submit to the court that the issue in the case is not who is to be charged with this particular situation. The issue in the case is whose rights and liabilities, whose obligations are to be lost as the result of this situation. The entire circumstances, it cannot be disputed. That the entire set of circumstances was the part of an error on the part of third parties, the title company on the one hand and the bank on the other, neither of which were the purchasers or the sellers in this contract, and none of which errors or mistakes caused any harm to the sellers in this particular case.
Because I understand your argument that the point is whether or not this is a condition preceding to the contract.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And not who's at fault about the question of the check.
The question of who is at fault, I submit to the court, is one which would naturally arise, especially to one trained in the legal world as far as analyzing the case. But if you set aside the question of who's at fault or whether it's at fault or whatever, the question here is who, if anyone, is to lose any rights under a contract? Because consider the fact, as soon as this became known to Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright, they did everything that they possibly could to deliver the funds to the title company and to perform the contract and to buy the land that Marion and Jean Wakefield had listed with the broker and were trying to sell and get rid of for the cash and purchase price consideration in the contract that Marion and Jean Wakefield freely and voluntarily signed with Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright. They tried to do that in more ways than they could possibly think of, and at all times after the first incident, the title company, everybody said, no, no, we're not going to do it. And Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright were prevented from doing what they were going to do under the contract, and quite frankly, from obtaining the rights that they freely contracted for, are ready, willing, and able to perform, and are entitled to under the law.
Would that money, $5,000, to be forfeited if the buyers had not gone through with the contract?
The contract provided that in the event, and there was a specific provision in the contract, which provided that under certain circumstances, the money in question would be forfeited to Marion and Jean Wakefield, the purchasers.
Okay.
That is in the contract.
Would it be a logical extension of your argument that if this rancher put up his ranch under the contract of sale, which is what he's really putting up, under the contract, he's put up the ranch. Your man is putting up the $5,000. Let's assume then that the check was, as in this instance, was returned, not paid. Would it then be the responsibility of the seller of that ranch then to go after and try to attempt collection of the $5,000 check, even though it took him 2 or 3 months to collect the $5,000? You say you still have a contract, and that the man's ranch is still locked in limbo under the terms of the contract?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I would say that under those circumstances, it is certainly the burden of all parties to perform what they are to perform under the contract. But under Your Honor's hypothetical, that would, of necessity, be based upon a position of the purchasers of not paying the money. I mean, for the rancher, under Your Honor's hypothetical, to make any efforts whatsoever to collect...
That would make a condition precedent, wouldn't it?
He is causing... I don't understand, Your Honor.
conditioned to the validity of the contract, or not as opposed to a covenant?
Oh, if it is specifically agreed that it is a condition rather than a covenant, that is different. But if there is no agreement, or if you have this contract here, it is not a condition, it is merely a covenant. And what happened in this case? Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright gave a check that was good. It was returned as the result of error. They wired the funds to the title company. The title company wouldn't take it. They delivered a cashier's check to the title company saying, we are ready to pay what we agreed to pay. We are ready to perform the contract. We want to buy the land.
Is there anything in the record as to why the title company would not accept the cashier's check they brought back in lieu of the insufficient fund check?
Yes, Your Honor. I specifically asked that question to the officer of the title company who was deposed and was personally handling the transaction. And there were two specific reasons, and none other, given. One, I didn't want to fool with it anymore. Number two, I didn't have enough time. It's not our corporate policy to do it. And that was it. And those were the only reasons given, and there were no other reasons given. And there was a specific question, was there any other reason why that was not done? No, there was no other reason.
And that was some 70 days or so after the check had been returned or after the contract had been written?
I believe that the date of the contract and the date of the tender of the cashier's check was approximately along those lines. But the date that Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright found out about it, no one told them either. And I think the record reflects that the date that they found out about it and the date that they finally tendered the cashier's check, during which time they asked the title company, run it through again, the title company wouldn't, they wired the funds of no benefit, they tendered a cashier's check, that period of time was significantly smaller, Your Honor. I think the record will reflect that. And therein lie some of the issues in the case, because Robert Hudson and Andy Wright wished to buy the land. They contracted for it, and they performed their contract. And they have been prevented to do so solely by the errors of other parties and by the refusal on the part of the purchasers, who admittedly are selling their ranch, but late, I submit to the court, under these circumstances, the purchasers, or rather the sellers in this case, they didn't want to keep their ranch. If it was their homestead, they didn't want to keep their home. They didn't want to keep living there. They wanted to sell it and to obtain the money under the contract. And Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright have been constantly and continually attempting to do just that, to give them the money in exchange for the property that they obviously didn't want anymore. They wanted to sell it. And under those circumstances, we submit to the court that the contract should be enforced. I submit it would be an egregious injustice for, under these circumstances, to have the failure of any party, be it the title company or be it the bank or whatever, to cause a contractual right under the law freely and voluntarily bargained for, freely and voluntarily signed, to be forfeited under these circumstances. Equity abhors a forfeiture. Equity will construe a contract to be a covenant rather than a condition. And the language of this contract, under the principles of construction set down by this court, which have been established and which are based upon sound reasons of law and policy, clearly mandate, I submit to the court, that it be construed as a covenant, not as a condition. If construed as a covenant, Robert Hudson and Andy Wright always have been and are ready, willing, and able to perform that contract, to pay the purchase price, and to buy the land. If construed as a condition, I submit to the court that it would fly in the face of many of the previous decisions of this court, including those laws that indicate that the payment of earnest money is not something that is a condition to the sale of real property. The sale of real property, though it must be in writing, is made and consummated and created, and the legal rights and obligations are created when the contract is signed, not necessarily when earnest money is delivered or when property is closed or things of that nature, unless conditions are specifically agreed to by the parties. This contract speaks for itself. And under these circumstances, this contract is clearly not a condition. And I submit to the court that this court should so hold and should enter a judgment and decree vesting title to the land in Robert Hudson and Andy Wright, and having Andy Wright perform what they are to perform, for they are ready, willing, and able to do so, now or at any time that this court should decide and determine that they are obligated to do so. And they seek such an order from this court, as do I.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bill Keels will argue for respondent.
Chief Justice Pope, Social Justice. First, I'd like to straighten up some fact questions that were presented about this insufficient check. think the record shows it was marked INF insufficient check. The bank, president of the bank, on page 6 of my brief, I quote from his letter, which is attached as P-22 to the stakeholder deposition, and he says, Fairfield State Bank, with the notation that there was were insufficient funds in the account of Hudson and Associates, and further that there was not as much as $5,000 in the account of Hudson and Associates at the time, but that is not uncommon. The banker said that the check was insufficient. The money wasn't in the account it was drawn on. This is a contract between a buyer and a seller. There's nothing in the contract that says that the stakeholder is going to send a check back through for the second time in case it's turned down, or send it back a third time, which is that it's turned down. The contract says that the buyer will deposit $5,000 cash. We wouldn't be here if he performed the contract. All he had to do was bring a cashier's check down on the 18th day of May, or whenever the March, whenever the contract was signed, lay the $5,000 check down, payable to the stakeholder. We wouldn't be here. Now then, is your normal channels of business. Of course, the stakeholder in her deposition, let it be known, and I think if all of you will just recollect a little bit any real estate transaction, where you are the stakeholder, it is certainly advisable for you to convert the stake to cash. In the event there's a breach of this contract, the sellers of the land not going to sue the buyer for the $5,000, they sue the stakeholder for the $5,000 because she is the holder of the stake. So it certainly wouldn't be unusual, and if I was advising the stakeholder, it certainly wouldn't be unusual to send it, if it's an out-of-town check, direct for collection. And by the way, a check when you give it, it's not a promise to pay in the next 3 or 4 days, it's a promise to pay right now. She could have put someone on a bus or got in a car and gone down and presented it to that bank and was entitled to be paid. It is a demand note, is what it is. It's not a promise in the future to pay. And the bank took care of itself, the bank vice president talking about how good of people they were and all of that, but he did say that this account was an insufficient at the time the check was presented, therefore it was returned. Now, one other thing over here, I've got a schedule of events here which shows that the check was put up on the 18th of March. Some 72 days later, they come up and put up a cashier's check. Well, of course, when the stakeholder found out that what funds was not there, the stakeholder did what she was supposed to do. She says there's no transaction anymore. Of course, she notified Mr. Wakefield of that, and I don't know whether the buyer knew it or not, but I think common sense will tell you in a real estate transaction, and they were real estate people because they're getting part of the commission on buying it themselves from another real estate agent. It looks to me like, as a real estate man, it wouldn't take him 72 days to find out that his check was insufficient. Now, in answer to Sheriff Kilgallen's question, distinguishing between the Texarkana case, I got him over there. The Texarkana case and the Tyler case.
No, the Tyler case in this case.
Tyler in. And
the language I read was from the Tyler case and from the contract.
All right, the Tyler case, which was decided right after the Texarkana case, if you read from the Tyler case, the statement in the Tyler case, if I can find it here, Calvin. Sham Properties. You read the provisions in the sham properties case, which you did read, Judge, and then you read what I've set out here for the court in my brief, which is the pertinent part of this contract, which is paragraph 7. And it reads practically the same as sham. For the purpose of securing the performance of purchaser under the terms and provisions of this agreement, which is the same as sham. Purchaser has delivered to Freestone County Title, Fairfield, Texas, sum of $5,000 cash to escrow deposit, which shall be paid by the title company to seller in the event purchaser breaches this agreement, as provided in Article 9 hereof. At the closing, the escrow deposit shall be paid over to seller and applied to the cash portion of the purchase price. That's the same as sham for all practical purposes. The distinction between sham, which is the Tyler case, which was decided in April of 1973, and the Texarkana case, which is relied on by petitioner Kalman, which was decided in October of 1973, after the sham case, the Tyler case, is this. The Texarkana case found that a contract existed, and the breach was not a material breach. The Tyler court held that no contract existed because he hadn't deposited $5,000 in this case. Therefore, there could be no breach because there was no contract existing. Now, the Tyler case, no red history, of course, on either one of them. The Tyler case relied on a Supreme Court case of Bowles versus Fickus, which the court is familiar with, 167 Southwest 2nd, 741. Because the Tyler court relied on that and cited that in the Supreme Court. Facts were practically similar to this. He supposed to put the money up, he didn't put the money up.
Now, that's not really what happened to Bowles, isn't it? Bowles, didn't the purchaser say, we got a contract when you sign it, and instruct the bank to have me put up $1,000?
The money wasn't put up, I don't believe, was it?
No, it wasn't put up. But wasn't that clearly a condition preceding Bowles? I mean, those are the two things going to happen. One, you sign it. Two, I got to put up $1,000. Wasn't that the fact situation in Bowles?
That's before you had a contract.
That's right.
All right, the same fact situation in this. You put up $5,000 and I sign it, we got a contract. Exactly the same situation, the way I see it. And the court under Bowles says, and the Tyler case cites Bowles, the facts is set out above. The thing which a bank was to hold in escrow for the parties was to be a contract. The instrument in question never acquired that character. Now then, also, you've got the Antwine case, which the Supreme Court handed down later, which in essence says that before you got a contract, you got to perform the escrow agreement.
Well, in Antwine, isn't it true that the parties never even agreed on what the earnest money would be, the amount of earnest money?
Yes, sir, but there was none ever put up, and it was agreed that so-and-so was to decide what the earnest money was going to be, I believe. In this case, Judge Chase sets the facts out as they existed, and he found that the check was marked insufficient funds, and he follows the Supreme Court in Bowles, Antwine, and of course the Tyler case. Now then, under the statement of counsel that I can't find all that he can find in the statement of facts as to where as to the money being in the bank, and the bank says that the money is there, and that there's no showing that the stakeholder didn't send it through a second time, and that was unreasonable, wasn't ordinary procedure in such actions. I can't see where he finds that is unreasonable and unordinary. Now then, under their theory of the case, they don't need any escrow money to bind anybody. They take the position that the seller by signing such a contract, and the buyer gives him a check, the check's not good, floats around for how long, then the buyer has really got an option on the seller's property. The seller's bound, but the buyer's not bound. The buyer's got a right to shop the property anywhere he desires, to sell the property. If the price is right, higher. The property is higher, then he goes and puts the $5,000 up. He buys it and sells it. If it's lower, then the only cause of action the seller's got, the rancher, the farmer, he's got a cause of action against the stakeholder. Says, where's my $5,000 cost? Because you know the contract is $5,000 cash and it'll be deposited with you. Under his theory of a real estate transaction, if the court follows that theory, then there will never be a need to make an escrow deposit to bind any real estate contract here after made in the state of Texas, unless it specifically says in there, and then you may find that it's not a material breach when they don't do that. You follow the holdings?
The condition preceding, the contract never comes into existence.
Yes, sir.
If it's a covenant, you still then have an issue of whether or not it's material.
Yes,
sir. That's the reason you have. But if it's condition preceding, the contract just never came into existence. So you could write it that way. But even in a case like this where there was a if there wasn't a condition preceding, you still could have a material breach of a covenant.
I agree with that. But I can't see, for the like of me, the way this contract is written, that this isn't a condition preceded to the performance of the contract. Where the section that I read says that this is part of the contract. Now then, the Texas County Court, in their rehearing opinion, sets out that where the consideration goes to the contract and not to the purchase of land, then in essence it is a condition preceding. I think we can agree with that. And this goes to the contract, not to the land. Of course, all of us know that I can say, I'll sell you 100 acres of land for $1,000, and you say, I will buy 100 acres, and I will pay you $1,000. That is a contract. There's no question about that. But I think I say where I say in there, and make it a condition preceding, but I'm not saying that it is a condition preceding, but drawing a picture of a condition preceding, that you've got to put up $500 with John Jones to hold for me, and in the event you don't buy this stuff, I get you $500. Now that's in layman's language, that's what it amounts to. Now that is really what has been done in this place. And in the event you do buy it, I still get the $500 and you owe me the balance. And in layman's language, that's exactly what this contract provides for, as I see it. And if we vary from that proposition in drawing a real estate contract, then we have dented the real estate business to where there will be cases from hereafter. I think the Tyler case is absolutely right. I think the Hudson versus Wakefield tracks Tyler. I think the Tyler case relied on the Supreme Court in Bowles and Atwine. I can distinguish the fact situation between the Tyler case and the Texas County case. The Texas County case was the delivery of the money supposed to be delivered to the seller, and he went to the bank. The Texas County case does not show that the money wasn't there. This case, there was no money. This thing don't say deposit a check with them. It says money. All right. Then the Texas County case, the Cowman, says, and then you've got a breach of the contract because the contract had existed because they were all in the office there together, but it's not a material breach. In the Tyler case, in the Waco court in this case, and I submit in the Supreme Court in the two cases, says that it ain't no contract, therefore there can be no breach. Really, petitioner can't complain of selling the land, the rancher selling the land after he found out the the escrow money wasn't there, because in their pleadings, in their first amended petition, which they filed sometime later, they admitted in that they knew the land had been sold for the second time. What were they expecting the seller to do? This case has been in court for 2 years, and he's supposed to be sitting there, and he is, in fact, sitting there holding this land when he wanted to sell it right there, and it all could have been solved by them performing one thing, and that was complying with his contract and putting $5,000 cash for the stakeholder. They the only one that could do that. The seller had to sign the contract. That's all he had to do. But not only did they have to sign the contract, they had to put up $5,000 cash, which they didn't do. And they didn't offer the $5,000 cash to some 72 days from the day of the contract.
They did put it up. It's the bank that messed up, wasn't it?
Pardon?
They did have it there. It was the bank that messed up, wasn't it?
I've never seen a hot check come back from the bank yet where it's the bank's fault, but I've heard a lot of people tell me that's where it's from. Now, I'm not saying that, and just common sense will tell me that. In fact, I've done it myself. I think it's not going to shoot it when the bank made a mistake. But I'll tell you what, if you read the banker's letter, I'll guarantee you the banker took care of the bank. He said it wasn't a mistake. He said that account was insufficient. But there's nothing in the contract. You're going to vary the term of a written instrument by parole evidence. If you're going to say you got... Send it through twice. Send it through three times. Send it by ordinary means. The contract don't say nothing about sending no money nowhere. It says $5,000 cash. And if that's there, then you got a contract. And I submit to you, it's just that simple. Now, if we change all the real estate transactions, all the real estate business, and the way it's done in the state of Texas, by saying that this earnest money is not a part of the contract, that it is a material breach, then how are you ever going to find a man's going to enter into a real estate contract and expect to go by it? Take an oil and gas lease. Same difference. They give you a draft in that, so they don't give you a check. There wasn't any draft given in this thing right here. They could shop this man, this farmer's land, for 72 days. They are real estate people. And he can't do nothing but sit there and twiddle his thumbs when he's wanting to sell his place and go back to Nebraska, wherever he came from. So he gets out and finds another buyer. And now it's tied up for 2 years. I submit to you that the controlling law is the Tyler case, and the Tyler case is certainly submitted by the Supreme Court in two opinions. Thank you.
Before you sit down, let me ask you this. You didn't address in your answer to this particular application his position that this was not a material breach, and therefore evidence would have been necessary. It's a fact issue, and that should defeat the summary judgment.
The writ was granted on number one, where the court erred in saying that the contract didn't exist. Isn't that correct? And number four, which said that was a summary judgment question, where there were facts there that such money there was waived. I believe that's in essence what he's trying to say. I could not find his points through his brief, to be frank with you.
Well, granted point of error number four, the factual dispute exists, precluding the granting the motion for summary judgment.
Those facts, I don't know what those facts would be, but if you're going on the premise of the Waco court and the trial court, the only question is whether or not there was a contract. And they say it wasn't a contract.
So you never even reached the question of materiality of breach because there was no contract to breach.
That's the assumption I've got. But now then, on the materiality, I can't... the evidence in there to support that would be that, he's got to show that there was the breach wasn't intentional if you got a contract, and that's showing that the check was not insufficient, that the bank made a mistake, that the stakeholder made a mistake, and that they didn't make a mistake, which I don't think there's any facts in there to that effect. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear the response from the petitioner.
Please, the court, I think it was very important right at the beginning to clear up one misconception, because respondents throughout the appeal of this case wish the courts to be under the impression that what happened is that my client signed the contract in this case and then shot the man's farm that he wanted to sell for 72 days before they put up the money. That's not the case. In this particular case, they signed the contract dated March 18, 1981, and they gave a check to the broker, and the broker appeared with respondents at the title company with respondents, knowing that it was a check and not cash, and respondents hand the check and the contract to the title company and say, we want to sell the land. Then in the course of signing a contract on that day or the next day with, as the record reflects, apparently his own lawyer, and thereafter releasing that contract, as the record also reflects, then during that period of the time the check was in process, the letters of communication sent by the title company, which are attached to the deposition of the officer in the title company on file in this case, established that at the end of April, not at the end of March, but at the end of April, well in excess of a month later, was the first time that the title company advised anybody that the check had been sent back. And right after that, Mr. Hudson indicated, the money's there, which I might add, the letter of the bank indicates, the affidavit to the bank officer indicates, and such is in the record. And I submit to the court that the affidavits, or rather the attachment to the deposition, and the affidavits and the letter of the bank officer say exactly that. That in that particular account, the money might not have been there, but the money was available at all times, and it
counsel,
was not forward.
This is one thing that gnaws on me. When you delivered the check, you didn't really deliver the check. You delivered a check that was encumbered with some kind of an agreement that was made hundreds of miles away. So you delivered really not a negotiable instrument. You delivered a check that was encumbered with many understandings that kept it from being a negotiable instrument. It was a special account that you are relying upon, not the check account.
Now, Your Honor, I would submit to the court that the check was a negotiable instrument and it was ready to be paid. And when it had been presented to the bank in the appropriate course of business, it would have been
well,
paid.
If you give me a check, do I have to know which bank officer I'm supposed to present that to?
No, Your Honor, you don't need to know that. But at the same time, Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright have a right to rely that ordinary and customary procedures will be done. And if you take that check and you use special procedures to deposit that check and you don't tell anybody, and the bank where the money is at all times is ready to fund that check, returns the check by accident or error, should that cause the forfeiture of legal obligations and rights, which involve over 200 acres of land?
I can understand that, but I'm having difficulty finding what the error or mistake was, because here was a negotiable instrument. It went through to the bank. They went to the account that it was drawn on, and the money's not there.
Well, the error was the bank not funding the money as the officer of the bank.
Then you have a lawsuit against the bank.
Well, I suppose that Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright possibly have some recourse against the bank, but at this time, Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright seek the land, the real property that they contracted to buy, and then Mrs. Wakefield didn't want to keep, they wanted to sell. And the bank, in the affidavit and the letter, reading the entire affidavit and the letter, and not that particular aspect ever concentrated on by the respondents, clearly indicates that the money was available at all times.
You keep saying the money was available. After this error was determined, does this record show that your client went to their account and put money in it?
No, Your Honor. This record shows that the account or the demand was made on the title company, that the check is good, run it through, and that if when the title company just refused to do that, the funds
was
were
the money
wired.
Put in the bank after it was determined that the check was returned?
The money was taken and wired to the title company's bank in Fairfield State, Texas, and when the title company wouldn't walk across the street to get it, the money was put in the form of a cashier's check and walked to the title company and said, here, we've been trying every way we can to perform this contract, here's your money. And I would again stress that this delay, regardless of what it was, and I think again the record will reflect the delay was not 72 days. From the time that everybody found out about this, the delay was less than a month, during which time demand was made, run the check through, funds were wired to the bank, and a cashier's check was tendered, all of which was refused to do on the part of the Wakefields and the title company. They absolutely refused to do it. And during that period of time, not 72 days, but significantly or at least less than 30 days, less than a month, as the records will show and the affidavits will show and the attachments to the deposition of the title company will show in this case, numerous efforts were made to do exactly that, deliver the funds to the title company. And there was only one thing that prevented that from being done, the actions of the title company and the Wakefield from refusing to take it. Now, I also submit to the court that under these circumstances, the contract read as a whole, it should be a covenant. And under these circumstances, Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright are ready, willing, and able, and have been ready, willing, and able to purchase that land. The money is available. Under the circumstances of this case, with the purchasers, or rather the sellers, desiring to sell the land, if they want to sell the land, they've got buyers. They've got buyers right here who are ready, willing, and able, and have been from day one to perform that contract and to sell the land. And I submit to the court that under those circumstances, the forfeiture of legal rights, by construing this as a condition precedent, not only would violate many previous provisions of the law of the state of Texas and would engraft upon the contracts of sale of real estate a condition that does not now exist in the law unless it is specifically agreed to by the parties, which in this case it was not agreed to by the parties, and I think the contract as a whole clearly indicates that, this court is going to be engrafting a requirement on the sale of real estate that now simply does not exist. It's not in the statutes. It's not in the statute of frauds. It's not in the common law of the state of Texas. It doesn't have to be there. The mutual promises, given that they are in writing, are sufficient consideration in the contract, is binding. And in this particular case, if Mr. Wakefield wanted to sell that property to Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright on the agreed upon price, rather than Mr. Wakefield's possibly attorney at maybe a higher price, we couldn't ever get that evidence in the depositions because those answers were refused to be given. But if Mr. Wakefield wanted to perform his promises, all he had to do was say, I want to perform. The money was available. Mr. Hudson and Mr. Wright tried to make it available. They did everything they could after they found out about it to make it available. They are ready, willing, and able to perform their obligations. And there is only one thing that has prevented them from performing their obligations throughout the pendency of this action. That is the refusal of the sellers, in this case, to perform the contract. I submit to the court, decisions of the court below should be reversed, and an order should be entered by this court decreeing specific performance.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court. The marshal will adjourn.
Your Honor,
please
rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court now stands adjourned, subject to call.